KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
The idea that we would have that kind of a free-for-all popping up right in downtown Seattle is unthinkable.
If you get a concussion at 10 or 11 or 12, you are predisposed to get future concussions at a different rate than if you'd never had one.
We didn't have to worry about how we looked. We could play anything because we were unseen, we were only heard. And so you could create anything you wanted to.
Today on the second hour, rolling into the second hour, the big show, radio actor Gloria McMillan is talking about performing for an audience that can't see you. We also heard from a doctor talking about the dangers of youth concussions. We're going to take that up in a few minutes. And State Representative Jamie Peterson talking about the gun show loopholes. And talking about the bazaar that popped up outside the gun show, the gun buyback in Seattle this Saturday. The bazaar of gun buyers offering to buy folks' gun for cash rather than the gift cards, and how that was legal. Some people were surprised that that sort of a private transaction was legal. But that is one of the things people look at when they look at gun restrictions and gun laws. They don't want to make it less legal, they say. They just want there to be a background check, even for those people who are buying and selling guns in private transactions. That's what Jamie Peterson, state representative from the 43rd, is talking about in introducing some new legislation regarding gun control in our state. I asked him what he thought of that gun bazaar.
The idea that we would have that kind of a free-for-all popping up right in downtown Seattle is unthinkable.
And yet legal.
And yet quite legal, and the police had absolutely no remedy to deal with it.
What would House Bill 1588 do to change that?
There's a federal and state exemption from the general requirement that people get background checks when they purchase firearms, and it applies to private sales. So if you buy from Cabela's or Walmart, then they have to run state and federal background checks on the purchaser. But if you buy off of Craigslist or at a gun show, then there's no requirement for a background check. This bill would just extend the requirement of background checks to apply to all sales of firearms.
Of course, the difficulty you'll have is that private person to private person, we don't have that kind of system in place. Might be difficult to set up, mightn't it not?
Well, actually, the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or NICS as it's called, is really easy. It's an online background check system that you can access for a $10 fee from local law enforcement or from dealers. So it should be very easy and relatively cheap for a private seller to comply with the law.
Why don't they so far then? If it's that easy, why wouldn't even NRA supporters say, well, this isn't much of an impediment to my freedoms?
Well, I think the interesting thing that we've seen in the public polling that's been done on this in the last month is that even 60% of NRA members support universal background checks. And something I just heard last night, that a New York Times CBS poll indicated that 90% of Americans support universal background checks for firearm purchases. So I do think that there is wide support for it. You know, really building on the idea that I think we have a pretty broad consensus that people with significant mental illness and people who are convicted felons ought not to have guns and ought not to have easy access to guns.
Yes, but of course that's people's concern is, you know, you're not going to get the felons, you're going to get just regular folks who want to trade their old grandpa's World War II heirloom.
Well, there's actually a specific exemption in the bill for antique firearms, which is a defined term in our statute. So those would not be subject to the background check requirement.
Now, what are the GOP counterparts in the House saying? You have some folks in the GOP that have different approaches, right? Liz Pike, she's got a different approach than what you're talking about.
Yes, she has. You know, what I've been impressed by, we've had a lot of quiet conversations here over the last few weeks, and I have two Republicans who have signed on to the bill, one from Eastern Washington and one from Western Washington, and I think quite a few others who, when the bill gets to the floor, will be voting for it. Now, it won't have universal support on the Republican side or on the Democratic side, for that matter, but I think that it's a small, reasonable step that I'm hopeful that we'll be able to take in the House, and hopefully we'll get it through the Senate and to the governor's desk.
Jamie Peterson is a 43rd District Representative. So, all right, so you chair the committee that's going to hear it, so you can bring it to the floor. You can bring it to a hearing, rather, and hopefully get it passed to the floor. I mean, Liz Pike wanted to have teachers carry guns if they undergo training and pass a psychological evaluation. You said that probably won't get a hearing. But isn't that, aren't you going to run into the same problem with a similar idea in the Senate? The senator who's holding the, who could hold hearings on that is saying he's probably not going to bring some of these ideas up.
Well, I had a good conversation with Senator Patton, who is the chair of the Senate Law and Justice Committee. That's my counterpart in the Senate, on Tuesday afternoon. And I think he's cool to the idea, that would be fair to say, but not completely closed to it. So my hope is that if we can have a good conversation and a strong bipartisan vote coming out of the House, then along with some good work by folks organizing and talking about the bill and about its importance, that we could put ourselves in a position where we could get it through the Senate as well.
Do you think, have you seen the lobbying that we hear takes place when these kinds of issues come up? I don't know if they'd be lobbying you directly because they probably figure you're a lost cause, but the people who don't support these new gun controls are reportedly down in the legislature pushing hard against these ideas. Have you seen it?
My committee has jurisdiction over gun issues, and so yes, when we have had hearings in the past on similar measures, then the NRA and aligned groups are typically pretty effective at turning out their members. I'm hopeful that the really broad coalition of labor and faith and business and other groups that's developed around the idea that we ought to be encouraging action against gun violence and stronger promotion of responsible gun ownership is going to be able to turn out a similar number of people when we do have the hearing.
Has it been any different this time in terms of the NRA and its supporters pressuring members?
You know, it actually has, although I've had one pro-gun group has organized some emails that have come to me so that they all look the same. I've had just a stunning number, probably 70 or so constituents who have written individual messages to me urging us to try to do something about guns and about gun violence in this session. So I really think that there's broad citizen frustration with our inability to regulate on this issue and substantial support that's just waiting to be organized and tapped.
This is a small step, Representative Peterson, if you were to get it passed, to get licensed firearm dealers and those people who do informal gun sales on the same page and the same system. But does it get to the heart of the matter, and what legislation would, do you think?
You know, I don't think that there's any panacea for this. There's no single thing that we can do consistent with the state and federal guarantees of the freedom to own a firearm that would eliminate gun violence in our country. There are a lot of small things that we can and should do. Those include making it harder for people who shouldn't have firearms to get them, probably some stiffer penalties and interventions that we can do with folks who commit crimes involving guns. We certainly need to make some better investments in mental health. And there's another bill that's moving through the process that would close up a gap for people who are not competent to stand trial criminally after they've committed a violent act, but on the other hand are not so mentally ill that they're considered incompetent for civil purposes. And so closing up that gap to make sure that those people get treatment and are not out causing more trouble on the streets is another thing that we could do. I think we need to we need to take a broad kind of long-term approach to these problems and just continue to work on them.
Representative Jamie Peterson of the 43rd Legislative District, he's going to hold a hearing on his bill for closing one of the gun show loopholes. He'll schedule it next week, and it is probably the hearing will be held in 2 weeks. This is Weekday. Citizens turned out in droves to protest the use of drones by the Seattle Police Department, but apparently there was barely a whimper of complaint when automatic license plate recognition technology was installed on several police cars. Matt Fixie-Verkirk, look, I did it wrong, Verkirk.
You got it.
Fixie-Verkirk is a writer for Crosscut. He has been looking into this. What is the automatic license plate recognition technology? Yeah?
Which I think we'll call ALPR to keep it easy.
Okay.
It's an impressive technology. It is cameras mounted on police cars of all sorts, connected to computers, that has the ability to automatically scan and read license plates, even moving at full speed down the freeway, thousands of them an hour, compare them to computer databases of suspects or offenders, and identify all kinds of people who might have either a warrant out for their vehicle, or maybe they've parked overtime. It logs time, date, and location, so they no longer have to chalk your tire. They can just drive around and scan licenses and tell when you've overparked. So if you don't have chalk on your tire, that no longer lets you off. And it's a great technology for doing what it does, but in the process of doing that, it scans tens of thousands of people's license plates, time, location, and logs all of that information. Most of those people aren't suspects. Most of them haven't done anything, and records it. And different departments, police departments and all across the country, handle that data differently. That's the question that people like the ACLU have raised, is what happens to all the data of the people who haven't done anything, aren't suspects, but it's this giant accumulating set of data. Seattle has almost 2 million scans in their system, and they now keep it for, they say, 90 days.
And has ACLU looked at this around the country and found some people keeping it much longer?
Yeah, ACLU has looked at it in 38 states that they've done disclosures or public disclosure requests or FOIA requests in, and they see that it's different everywhere. Some departments don't delete any of it. Some of them have a policy. Two states have enacted legislation on this, Maine and New Hampshire, to limit the use of the data. And there's an expectation. The folks at the ACLU here say they expect perhaps legislation to come out in Washington this year on this topic as well.
How long has it been around?
It's been around for some years. Seattle has now, I think they started using it 4 or 5 years ago, but they've continued to expand their use of it. They're now using it on 12 different vehicles in both patrol and parking enforcement. But they also say if they have an investigative need, which could be anything, they look at the data.
Now, vehicle registration data is deemed private by Washington state law.
Yeah.
But license plate numbers and their locations, that's public information.
Yeah.
What prompted you to look at this for Crosscut?
Well, I was just interested in the technology once I learned about it. And once I saw how it had been looked at in other places, for example, like in Minneapolis, the Star Tribune there did a story where they actually tracked the whereabouts of the mayor to see where he's been. And in...
So they did a public disclosure?
They did a PDR. They got all the data. We've requested all the data, which our PDR is pending for Crosscut. So we'll...
all the data?
All 1.7 million. And then we'll see... And several people have requested it in the past, and at least one of them has been provided it already because it's considered public. You can walk down the street and look at license plate numbers. The transformation is the technology that lets you do that by the tens of thousands and then record it, and then you have a history of where everybody's been. The assumptions can be made and assumptions could be wrong. Parked next to a religious institution, parked near a clinic. There's all kinds of things that can be assumed or presumed that may not be correct.
So is that part of what aroused your suspicion?
Well, I just thought it was interesting because I saw the ruckus that came when the drones were announced. And the drones are like remote control planes. You can go to the shopping center downtown Seattle and buy a drone for $200 that does the exact same thing.
Really?
Around, control it with your iPhone.
I need a drone.
Yeah, I'm trying to talk Crosscut into getting one.
But the Crosscut drone.
And that created all kinds of intense focus. But the reality of this new form of sort of longitudinal big data collection create something that is probably of a similar level of concern but is barely noticed.
I am fascinated by the fact that they don't have to chalk my tires anymore.
Nope.
So does that mean that the person driving around in those little cars, they have that and they can access that data?
Some of them do.
Very quickly.
And it's not like the old days where the guy had to type it into a keyboard. It's running all the time. They'll run they'll acquire tens of thousands every day.
Oh, so there's probably some program by which they cruise back by in some time and it pops up.
The computer just goes boop. If you look at the story on CrossCut, there's a link to a demo, and you'll see these guys driving around full speed on the freeway or around the neighborhood, and it will tell them when somebody is parked overtime because that car is located in the exact same spot it has been for X number of hours.
So where does the story go from here for CrossCut? You want that information?
We've done a public disclosure request for the data so we can look at it in detail and see what we may find in it. And then the question is, how should that data be protected? Should, you know, in the old days, if we sent police detectives to community meetings or parking lots and logged everybody's license plate, that would have raised a real ruckus. Now it's easy to get that information. So how do we protect it, or how do we protect its misuse? And Seattle is just one department, but across the whole state, different departments use this different ways. The toll system on the bridges uses it. And so the question is, who's getting the information and who are they sharing it with?
How does Orca and the Orca card fit into this?
Well, people have said, well, they can't track me because I don't drive a car. Well, the interesting thing is your Orca card is a really excellent device. Your personal information isn't on it most of the time, but still 400,000 people tap in and tap out every day, and the data just keeps building since April of 2009 when the system started. And so it's a giant amount of data about who has traveled where, when. You can't necessarily do anything about it, but there is an app actually now on the Android store that will let you scan your Orca card. And most people don't realize their last 10 trips are stored on the card.
So my number, my Orca card, the number that I have on my card, that's stored.
Yeah.
They know where I've been.
They do if they know your number.
Yeah, and that's probably not that hard to find.
It's probably not that hard. In fact, if you hand me your Orca card, I'll
tell you. Yeah, I know. I could show it to you, but there you are. All right. Well, so more stories to come.
Yeah, there will be a follow-up on this and maybe another one on the Orca card.
We put a link to Matt Fitzsever-Kirk's article, Never Mind the Drones. The SPD already knows where you've been, from CrossCut at KUOW.org. Matt, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
It's weekday.
Is football safe for kids? We'll take that up in a minute. Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Hubbard Street Dance Chicago, performing two works by Israeli choreographers, February 9th at the Paramount Theater. More info at stgpresents.org. Forty-seven degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 50. It's been raining off and on this morning, and rain is likely to continue through the rest of the day. Then we're looking at a chance of showers overnight, dropping down to 41, and tomorrow, Friday, partly sunny with a high of 51. I'm Bernard Ouellette. We're going to travel back to the golden age of radio to find out what drew people to work in radio back in the 1930s and 40s. That's 20 minutes away. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Now, football and its safety, the greatest media spectacle of all time, Super Bowl. That's this weekend. Which got us, as well as many other people, thinking about the crisis the NFL is facing. 33 deceased former NFL players have been found to have suffered from a degenerative brain disorder called CTE, brought on by years of head trauma and concussions. Six of those players committed suicide, and so people are wondering, well, is it safe? President Obama said this week, if I had a son, I'd have to think long and hard before I let him play football. So is it safe for young people to play football? We wanted to take that up. Dr. Kim Harmon is professor in the Department of Family Medicine and the Department of Orthopedics and Sports Medicine at the University of Washington. She also serves as associate head UW team physician with primary team responsibilities for football and women's basketball. Dr. Harmon, thanks for talking to us.
great to be here.
And Chris Gradwell is a youth football coach, vice president of the Northwest Junior Football League. He's coached youth football for 14 years. Thank you for being here.
You bet.
So, Dr. Harmon, first, a little bit more. What are we talking about when we talk about a concussion or head trauma or CTE? What's happening to the body?
Well, what happens when someone gets a concussion is they get a blow to the head, or sometimes not even a blow to the head, but there's trauma to the brain, and there's the brain doesn't have enough energy to continue its normal functions, and so you'll get certain symptoms, headache, dizziness, confusion, and then it takes a while for the brain to recover. But what the chronic changes are is that down the road, we're afraid that some of this problem may be cumulative and sort of build up and cause problems down the road.
I see. Well, all right, so given what we know about it, let's just start with that. Is it safe for young people to play football? Let's just start with the youngest of peoples, you know, kids that are in their first few years of playing in youth leagues and getting a little older.
Well, I think that millions and millions and millions of kids have played football, and we don't really have millions and millions of people that have this problem. And really, when kids are very, very little, they can't hit all that hard. And so probably having little kids play football isn't the problem. The impact of the collision gets progressively increased as players get older and stronger and bigger. And so probably more of the problem might lie in some of the older players. And in addition, you know, it's not just football where people get concussions. It's certainly a sport where a lot of people get concussions, but people get a lot of concussions snowboarding or doing a lot of other things, playing soccer. And so we're not just talking about football here. We might be today, but concussions happen in a lot of other things other than football.
Yeah. By the way, so kids are smaller, they don't hit as hard, but are in any way physiologically, are kids more susceptible to concussions or less susceptible to concussions than adults?
Well, we think that their brains are probably more susceptible to concussions, and their neck muscles probably aren't as strong, and so they can't necessarily absorb blows as easily as adults. And so there's that concern as well. And we don't really have great epidemiologic studies in kids to know how many kids get concussions because you need numerators and denominators to do those sorts of studies, and we don't have great information.
So in terms of concussions, though, when if we have multiple concussions, we heard about these suicides. What are some of the other effects of concussions on a person? Do we assume that there will be mood disorders or depressions or migraine?
The vast majority of people that have concussions have symptoms that are limited to a day or two, and then they gradually go away. And they're fine, and they don't have any sequelae after that. And that's what happens in the vast majority of concussions. There's a small subset of people that continue to have problems, that may have mood disorders, that may have concentration difficulties, that may have balance problems. And so those are the people that we worry about. And we can't pick out those people. And that may be people who have repeated concussions, or it may happen to somebody the first time they get concussed. You just don't know.
You don't see anything different about their concussion than the other people?
No, and it may be actually that they are genetically predisposed to not being able to tolerate head trauma as much.
Huh. Dr. Kim Harmon is professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Orthopedics Sports Medicine at the UW. She also has responsibility for the football and women's basketball team in terms of as head physician, as one of the head physicians. So, Chris Gradwell, what do you think about this controversy? First of all, you've coaching football for 14 years. Did you play football?
I did. I grew up in Seattle playing youth football through the Boys and Girls Club and started playing when I was 8 years old. And I have five younger brothers. We all played up through.
So what do you think of this issue? How does it affect you personally and professionally?
Well, I think quite clearly it is a very serious issue. It needs to be taken seriously. Unfortunately, what's happening is people are drawing correlations between professional athletes and 8-year-old kids. And there's just so many dramatic differences. And Dr. Harmon commented on several of them.
But haven't we had some incidents with kids in high school that have had concussions, that have either been severely injured by them or some cases died?
Absolutely. Going back to Dr. Harmon's point, one of the things that we know is as the kids get older and bigger, the risk increases. And for kids under the age of 14, football is amazingly safe. It is safer than people would know. It's one of the safest activities that kids can participate in.
How is that? What makes it safe?
Well,
is it because of the weight again? Is it because?
Well, I think that it's a number of factors, and of course, Dr. Harmon mentioned the fact that we've got size and as you know, mass, velocity, all of the science behind that. The kids are simply smaller. They're well padded and protected, and they don't have far to fall.
All right, but have you seen changes in player safety over the years you've been coaching?
Absolutely. I was thinking about the equipment that I played with when I was a kid, and I look at the equipment that the kids are using today. It's dramatically better. Now, equipment can't prevent concussions, but it can reduce the possibility. And so we've seen a number of changes. Number one, we've seen change in equipment. Number two, we've seen some rule changes at all levels that help reduce the potential. And we're also seeing because of this emphasis, some increased investment in research and testing that will lead to even further benefits.
One of the things that the NFL has done, right, is crack down on helmet-to-helmet contact. Has your league done the same thing?
We have. Our league, we play under the high school rules, the National Federation of High School rules, and they changed their rules several years ago to put emphasis on head-initiated contact. It's illegal.
You know, here's the and does it work? I mean, you got kids. You know, you can have rules and you have kids.
Well, certainly it works. You're just because you have a rule doesn't mean that people don't violate it. We have penalties in football games, but certainly players and coaches try and avoid those. So it is definitely having an impact, but. Again, I think that as we learn more, there's more to do.
So we got this email from Shelley, Dr. Harmon. My daughter is in her fifth month of waiting for her concussion symptoms to resolve after a summer of extensive tournament play on two teams. I don't know what sport. This has been very difficult for emotionally, academically, 50% participation in school, freshman in high school, socially, and of course athletically. Her life is on hold until her brain gets better, which will be who knows. Who knows? What do we know about how we heal?
Well, you know, with the brain, it mostly just takes time. But one of the things that we're wondering about in adolescents now is that we've gone from having people be active and playing sports and doing all their schoolwork to pulling them from activity entirely. And so if you take somebody who's an athlete and defines himself as an athlete and then you pull them from activity completely, that itself can cause a lot of depression and anxiety and problems too. And so now we're thinking about a concept of and I certainly can't comment on this case in particular, but about letting people go back to some sorts of activity just because it's so hard to take an athlete and take them completely out of activity. And so there's different protocols about getting kids back into some sort of activity because it's really hard to take an athlete out of activity completely because that can cause depression as well. And there are definitely terrible concussions, but for instance, this one, I'm presuming as a female, there's not all that many females that play football, that this one happened in a different sport.
Yeah. Well, here's another issue here, another emailer raises. This is, I know both of you have thought about this. It's patently obvious to me that almost all the injuries in American football are caused by the equipment itself. The players use their helmets to ram each other and the shoulder pads to defer the blows by the helmets. Less protective equipment is the answer. Take international rugby, arguably the toughest game in the world. 30 players, no helmets, no plastic pads, incredibly hard-crunching tackles, and very few serious injuries. Let me start with you, Chris. Is this emailer right? Is Ron and Paulsbo right? Is this about the equipment?
I know some rugby players. I think that I would disagree, but I think that we're both entitled to our opinion. I think that what's really important is that we we're intelligent about this and we leverage the research that has been done and is being done. And we make the right improvements and changes that are going to benefit everybody at all levels.
What kind of training do you get, and what do you give your coaches?
So what we take this very seriously. And so in our particular league, we require all of our coaches to go through two types of training. One, we go through a football training through USA Football, and that's very important. So one of the things that we know, based on some research done by the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury, they out of the University of North Carolina, they track not only severe injuries but what the cause was, and proper technique is extremely important. And we see this emphasis supported by the NFL through a program called Heads Up. So teaching the right blocking and tackling techniques is huge. So our coaches go through that training. We also have our own certification training. All of our coaches are required to go through certification training, and we cover concussions. And, of course, we do not teach coaches to diagnose concussions. What we teach our coaches is to recognize warning signs, symptoms, and events. And if there is any risk, the player is removed from play, and that player does not return to play until we have a letter from a physician saying that, you know, Joey is authorized to return to contact.
Part of the danger is the repeated concussion, right? The repeated hit. How do you avoid that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is how much we're learning, right? And there was a lot of perceptions, and it's evolving. Certainly, we know for a fact that if someone sustains a head injury, returning to play too soon, in other words, before they've recovered, increases their risk dramatically. And so that is critical. But it's not always a big hit. What they've discovered is that not all hits are equal. And so, you know, all of the testing and research predominantly was based on what they call linear acceleration, which is like a center of mass hit on hit. And what they've discovered is, and the research is starting to accelerate through schools like Virginia Tech and Wake Forest, is that these what they call rotational impacts are more are of higher risk, where the head is going to actually turn quickly versus, you know, kind of go back and forth. With that kind of research, we're able to improve the equipment, we're able to improve the training. And so our coaches all have to go through that certification, so they have that concussion awareness, they have the proper teaching techniques, and they're all going to get a badge. And if they don't have the certification, photo ID, then they're not allowed on the sidelines.
You have to also change the attitude of the player and the parents to understand the significance of the hit.
Absolutely. I think that's a big cultural change. And we think back, you know, I'm 52 years old, and a lot of the older folks that are listening that played football can probably remember times where they were playing sports and they took a big hit and probably should have been removed from play, and, you know, the coach would say something like, "Oh, you just got your bell rung.
Shake it off."
Right. Or my favorite one was, you know, you would see a coach go to a player and say, "Billy, are you okay?" And Billy, what's Billy going to say? "Yeah, I'm ready to go, coach." And I think we can all universally agree it's a bad idea to seek medical advice from 10-year-olds. What's really interesting, whether we talk about football or all sports, when you look at head trauma and related injuries in youth, it's almost universally a failure of the adults in their lives. And so it's important. So we not only we train the players, the parents, and the coaches, but the emphasis, especially in youth football, has to rely on the parents and the coaches, because we're not going to rely on the 8-year-olds.
Chris Gradwell is a youth football coach and vice president of Northwest Junior Football League. We're talking about injuries to athletes and concussions and how they affect their careers, how they can be avoided. So CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said about 7.2% of football-related visits to emergency rooms for kids under the age 19 were for concussions. Now, Dr. Harmon, you when you were talking about, you know, as kids get older, as people get older, then it's more hitting. Well, you got football players in college who are pretty big and they hit hard. How does the UW, for example, approach keeping people safer on the field?
We do a lot of different things. And so, first of all, you know, it all starts with technique. And we have probably less hitting practices than we used to. And when somebody has symptoms, we pull them out. And then there's a very specific protocol in terms of somebody having to pass certain milestones to get back in. We do baseline testing. at the beginning of the season so that we have benchmarks to benchmark our players to make sure that they're okay before they go back in. And so we have all sorts of concussion protocols to try and keep them safe. And, you know, if somebody just doesn't feel right, we'll pull them.
Have there been concussions in the UW football this season?
Oh, certainly.
Oh, just you know, it's happened.
Mm-hmm.
And those players accepted this sitting on the sidelines for the time it took for them to heal.
You know what? I've been on the football sideline for 25 years, and it's been really interesting because it used to be the players would hide their concussions, and there's been a real change in the last probably 3 years or so as there's been more media attention to this, where people will now come up to me at practice and say, you know what, I have a headache. I think I might have a concussion. And I'll say, well, did you get hit? And I'm like, no. I'm like, well, do you think maybe it's just a headache? I'm like, well, it could be. You know, and so there's a real awareness among players about concussions, or players – or they used to sort of help hide symptoms from the coaches or the medical staff and tell somebody who didn't know whether to run left or right what the play was. Now they'll call out their buddies and they'll bring them over and say, you know what, he is not right. He's got a concussion. You got to look at him.
Hmm.
And so there's been a real shift in among the players in terms of self-reporting and in terms of reporting on their teammates.
In terms of research, you have these players, the NFL player Chris Henry died in a car accident in 2009, and when he was diagnosed, they saw, after his death, his autopsy, they saw he had CTE. I understand what you say about the health risks of playing football with these issues. He was there for 5 seasons, but what do we learn from these cases about the research itself? What needs to be known? What is already known about CTE and concussions?
Well, you know, that it's very provocative problem because you have this horrible, horrible issue, but we don't know how many people have normal brains that played football. And so we don't know if this is 1% of the people that played football and we're just seeing it, or if it's 10% of the people that played football, or if it's 20%. And so what we really need is more people that don't kill themselves or die at an early age. We need to look at their brains too. There's some new technology that perhaps we're going to be able to do that, which will be very helpful. And so we really need more research before we can jump to any conclusions that this is a huge problem. I mean, certainly it's a problem, and certainly it's a scary prospect. But right now, all we have is a problem, and we have this effect. We don't know. We can't quite connect the dots yet.
Do you have kids?
I have 4 kids, 4 boys.
Do they play football? Will you let them play football?
3 of them play football.
Any sport you don't let them do?
I don't let them jump on trampolines.
Interesting. For similar reasons, you're worried about injuries.
I'm worried about spinal cord injury with that.
Very interesting. All right. I appreciate you both taking the time. We'll leave it there and we'll come back to it. Dr. Kim Harmon is a professor in the Department of Family and Medicine, Department of Orthopedics and Sports Medicine at the University of Washington. Chris Gradwell is a youth football coach, and he's coached youth football for 14 years. He's now vice president of the Northwest Junior Football League. Thank you both.
You bet.
This is Weekday.
A trip back to the golden age of radio in a minute. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Before actress Gabourey Sidibe made her film debut as Precious, many people doubted her abilities.
To be fair, a lot of people thought that I wasn't going to be an actress. So it's sort of fun to make people wrong.
Now Sidibe is hosting a documentary series about life, art, and pop culture in the African diaspora. We'll talk about it next time on Tell Me More.
That's this afternoon at 1 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. Learn more at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from Citizen University, a conference on the art of great citizenship featuring Tony Kushner, Howard Gardner, and more. March 23rd at Seattle Center. Early bird registration at citizenuniversity.us.
1044, I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 47 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. It's been raining off and on this morning, and that's probably going to continue through the day. Today's predicted high is 50. A lunch recommendation and a cookbook recommendation from food blogger Sarah Dickerman in 15 minutes.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Katie Sewell's back with our radio retrospective. People who work in radio often hear, why'd you go on the radio? Sometimes people look at me and say, I know you went to work in radio, but you know, the whole face for radio thing. But you were thinking about why people do work in radio, actually, how they answer that question.
Well, yeah, they always ask, why not TV or film? It's so much more interesting and glamorous. And this back in the golden age of radio, even when you'd think that everyone would want to be into radio, radio actors were still asked that same question. Why would you not want to be in Hollywood on the screen? And so I thought, why don't we talk about the reasons why they liked working in radio?
Well,
the first one is it was steady.
You got paid.
You steady work. They say that even the best film actors couldn't find steady work. And in radio, you could actually work 52 weeks a year. There was enough work if you were good enough to raise a family, stay in one place, and keep working. And I wanted to tell a funny story. Like Jeanette Nolan, who was a very well-known radio actress of the time, she's in nearly everything, if you look back. She dropped out of college and turned on the lead in a play because she needed steady work. It was during the Depression, and so she got a job at the famous department store for $2.37 an hour. And while she's there, while she's there, she runs into a friend who tells her about radio, and you're a great actress, you should be in radio. So she goes and auditions for a man, and she gets a job. And before I tell the rest of the story, let's hear what Jeanette Nolan's like on the radio.
I'm so glad that you've agreed to take on this assignment. You see, Laird Douglas Douglas means everything to me. And I have the utmost confidence in you. I'm sure Laird Douglas will, too.
Well, thank you very much. But where is he?
Why, yes, Mrs. Van Patten, what's happened to him?
Oh, don't worry, my dear. He's all right. He sat down in your chair and fell fast asleep. Oh, if I could only relax that way. But you must meet him, Mr. Dollar.
Yes, I'd certainly like to.
Of course you would. And I know he'll want to meet you. Gently now. Oh, good, he's awake.
Oh, no. That's Laird...
Laird Douglas, Douglas of Heatherscote. This is Mr. Johnny Dollar. Let go of Mr. Dollar's leg. Douglas, dear. Douglas.
He was a dog.
Yeah.
All right, so.
You can see how good she is at doing voices, though, and making herself sound a lot older than she is. So she gets this first radio job, and she runs in to tell her boss at the department store that she has to quit. She got a cast in a play for radio, and they're going to pay her $7.50 a day. And her boss says, you know, listen, you keep your job. If you get a lot of work, we'll let you go. You know, then you can let the job go, but you should keep this job. And it was not very long before she could just walk in and quit the job for good because she was that good. And she could get, you know, up to, 15 scripts a week?
Gosh, because they could just crank it out.
Yeah.
All right, so steady work, less pressure.
Less pressure because you don't have to look a certain way. You don't have to wear costumes. You don't have to wear makeup. Nobody has to memorize any lines. You never need to be on a diet. All you need for work is you just show up with a red pencil. You mark up the scripts. All the actors own one or two suits that they can throw on in case they have to be in front of a live studio audience. And otherwise, they just sort of waltz in and perform. They don't have to work on it too hard. So we had Gloria McMillan into the studio back in 2007, and she talked about this very thing.
Costumes and makeup and all, it didn't matter. It was just the words and the relationships of these characters that was so meaningful, and we didn't have to worry about how we looked. We could play anything because we were unseen, we were only heard. And so you could create anything you wanted to.
Gloria McMillan played Harriet in the show Armis Brooks. That was her main role.
So that's her second point, that you can be anonymous.
Exactly.
That's your third point.
Yeah. Fans don't recognize you, which was one thing that, you know, you think that maybe if you're an actress, you'd like to be recognized. But people in radio don't always want to be known by the general public. In fact, they were so not mobbed by this like the screen stars were that people in the industry used to call them the quietly rich. Because they were able to perform.
At $7.50 a day?
Yeah, they were able to perform, but they didn't have to have their whole lives disrupted by what they did. And then, but later on, fans, of course, they want to know what their people they're listening to look like. And so these fan magazines start popping up to show them. And in the fan magazines, they have to dress up in the costumes as the characters they play. Otherwise, it would burst the bubble.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a great picture, if you look it up, of the 1930s show Buck Rogers, where they're all in tights and helmets because that took place in the future. And so they're dressed in future costumes. But back, you might recall that I interviewed the director and writer Norman Corwin a few years ago. And we talked about the publicity photos that people post for these magazines. And I pointed out that generally when he was photographed, he always had a pen in his hand or he was shown directing other people. And he had this to add.
I one time affected, and that's the proper term, affected a pipe. And it was photographed smoking a pipe, which I hardly ever did. But it looked manly in the photograph, and therefore I consented to pose with one.
So, never hurts to look manly in a photograph when you're trying to get some cred with the listeners.
I'm going to try to do that.
I'll take a few pictures of you with a pipe in your hand. I don't know, would that give you the same kind of manly cred these days? Who knows? Fourth reason.
Big Mersham pipe, like Arthur Conan Doyle, like Sherlock Holmes would have. Like, Basil Rathbone probably didn't smoke a pipe either, and that's how you always picture him.
Yeah, that's pretty much true.
All right, finally, what they thought about, you know, my barbecue set that I just got for working 25 years at University of Washington. I could hold the barbecue set. That would give some credibility to my work.
That was worth the 25 years.
All right, so freedom.
Freedom
is their the final idea.
The number one thing, freedom. Because on the radio, you can be anyone you want to be. It doesn't matter what you look like, how old you are, how tall or short you are. It was all about how well you could act with your voice. And so these actors who couldn't get roles on screen sometimes because they were too tall or they were too short or they just weren't pretty enough could suddenly be leading men and women on the radio. And they would play opposite blockbuster stars. So I could be somebody who can't get a job in the films, and all of a sudden I'm acting opposite Cary Grant on the radio. Granted, Cary Grant's getting paid like 10 times more than
me. $7.50 a day.
Which eventually, you know, these radio people go after more money for that very reason. But we'll get into that some other time. But I wanted to mention Lorraine Tuttle, who was one of radio's most versatile actresses during the Golden Age. She's also like Jeanette Nolan in almost everything. And she was so busy that she would do 15 different shows a week. And she, when I was reading about this, said this about the freedom that radio gave her. She said, "I could play opposite Jimmy Stewart or Cary Grant. And on the air, I could be the most glamorous, gorgeous, tall, black-haired female you'd ever see in your life. I was whatever I wished to be. And I could do it with my voice," and that was the thrilling part. So just in reflection of that, I thought we'd listen to her. One way people remember her is as the Secretary Effie on The Adventures of Sam Spade.
Whatever did you do to your hair?
Well, I brushed it out, Sam.
What happened to the pin curls?
I told you, Sam, when it was brushed out, it wouldn't be noticeable.
Hours of torture sitting under a hot dryer for something nobody will notice.
But, Sam, it puts bounce in your whole makeup.
Eyeshadow, new shade of lipstick. You look real gone.
Oh, no.
Whom is it tonight?
Well, it's his friend of Maud, Sam. Of course, she's not really serious about him, so it's all right. And he's definitely not serious about her. I mean, he...
Well, have fun, sweetheart, while Maud burns.
Oh, well, she won't.
Effie was a great character.
She is a great character, but what you might not know, Steve, is that she was so good that she played, like, usually almost all of the female roles in every single episode of Sam Spade. They rarely hired another woman to be on that show. And so just for fun, to end this segment, I thought, why not hear another character she plays in the exact same episode?
Where are we going?
I've got a little hideaway down the coast. It's right on the beach at the foot of a tall cliff.
Hmm.
There's a fireplace, a little bar, some records, hidden away from the world. You feel so safe.
Mm-hmm. Don't stop.
You'll like it there. You feel as if there's no one else on earth. Time standing still.
Oh, if I could just be sure that Mother wouldn't worry about me.
You're impossible.
Wow, quite an actress. That she sounds so different in those two roles.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks, Katie. We'll talk. We'll talk about some of these. Let's talk at one of these times about their money, because that money changed sort of the way old time radio and the Golden Age radio evolved.
Yep.
This is Weekday.
Thank you.
And now we end the fine Thursday, as we do, with a conversation with Sarah Dickerman. Writes for Slate, The New York Times, blogs at sarahdickerman.com. But she's here in our studios.
Hello.
With a stout coffee cake with pecan caraway streusel. That looks lovely. And I am going to be eating some.
I love a good coffee cake.
The Blue Bottle Craft of Coffee, Growing, Roasting, and Drinking with Recipes.
Yes.
Is the book.
So it's a book that you wouldn't think would be a great pastry cookbook, and I—that's why I'm mentioning it, because it's a really good book on coffee from one of the Bay Area's really great coffee companies. If you want to learn how to pull the perfect espresso shot, if you're really interested in nail filter coffee drip method, you know, total coffee geekery, it's a good book. But the reason I like it is because it has really lovely, pretty easy to make pastry recipes in the back of the book. The second half of the book is dedicated to pastries that go well with coffee.
Which, as you mentioned, has been something that is important to you.
Yes. In my past, back when I was writing for The Stranger, I went on a bit of a tirade about how bad the pastries were in Seattle's wonderful coffee shops. And, you know, sometimes they've gone up and down over the years since I wrote that. But I'd say overall, it's generally a de-emphasized thing. And so you end up going and having this amazing, perfect, beautiful ristretto shot. And then, you know, the pastry's kind of 2 days old and a little dry and crumbly.
So we would like to change that, and this recipe gets us on the way.
This is a great one for home cooking. I love this stout coffee cake because it's got that very earthy, malty flavor of the stout, and then wonderful pecans are just such a delicious nut, and a little bit of caraway gives it almost that Irish soda bread quality.
There is stout in here?
There is stout in the cake itself.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. But there's also other interesting recipes. There's a really nice little sesame cookie that has a little bit of absinthe, or you could use another anise-flavored liqueur in it.
Sesame absinthe cigars?
Yeah. And then there's beautiful olive oil, an olive oil shortbread. All sorts of things that are just, I love pastries that just have a little bit of a savory element that aren't all sweetness. I mean, I like sugar, but I like a little complexity.
So, is there a pastry shop? I didn't ask you this beforehand. So, if you go, I don't know. Is there a pastry shop or a coffee shop that you really like their pastries of? They say, oh, that's one I'm going to go get. Since your tirade, has anybody stepped up?
Oh, I mean, there are amazing bakers in Seattle, and there are amazing coffee shops. I think the overlap sometimes isn't there as much as I'd like. I mean, something like Crumble and Flake or Hot Cakes or...
Is Crumble and Flake a place, or what happens? Crumble and Flake is a place?
Yeah, you go to get pastries that crumble and flake when you eat them. And Hot Cakes is great in Ballard, and as is the ever wonderful Baisalou. So those are great bakeries. I think, you know, there's great bakeries to be had in Seattle.
All right, we'll leave that there. You know what? Just in because we always get it from you, we'll take more time, talk about it next week. But Greenleaf? Is that the one in the old Labor Temple downtown?
It is, and that's part of the fun of it.
Have you been to that building?
Yeah.
It's a great old building. People should go in just to see
it. Just to smell it.
Yeah, Sam Spade. It's from the 30s and 40s. It feels like you're still there. And then this Greenleaf is a restaurant that you enjoy.
Oh, it's a terrific Vietnamese restaurant.
All right, that's down in, what is that, in First?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On Cedar. I forget which the cross street is, where the Seattle Labor Temple is. But
yeah, as Belltown's tapering off.
Yes, yeah. As Belltown tapers off. Sarah Dickerman, she has brought in a cake for us, from a stout coffee cake from the Blue Bottle Craft of Coffee, and we'll talk more about Greenleaf next time. But check it out and check the Labor Temple out. Thank you.
Thanks.
Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jez Magano, Amin Al-Saadi, Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. We will talk to you again tomorrow. Have a good day.
Ten fifty nine.
The Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris is getting 9 new bells just in time for its 850th birthday. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to producing safe, healthy milk that starts with maternity programs with pure feed and fresh water for healthy baby cows. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
The Super Bowl festivities in New Orleans got off to a rough start when Ravens star linebacker Ray Lewis was accused of using deer antler spray to improve his performance. Lewis angrily denied it, pawed the ground, and then impaled Bob Costas on his horns. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that obviously is not performance enhanced. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Yes, there will be a quiz. Sharpen your pencils and tune in Saturday morning at 10.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Cancer Care Alliance's new Proton Therapy Center.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.